UST. Together, we build for boundless impact.
A rare tropical storm drenches the southwestern U.S. Plus, an all-star team of Wall Street investors bid for America's largest publicly traded hedge fund, and why India's growing economy doesn't feature a growing number of working women.
There have been some efforts by the government to make headway, and despite that, you can see the numbers. It hasn't really been working.
It's Monday, August 21st. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Residents of Southern California are assessing the damage from the first tropical storm to hit the region in nearly a century. Tropical storm Hillary made landfall on the Baja coast yesterday, and as of late Sunday, officials in Los Angeles had reported downed power lines citywide and a pair of mudslides in a region that's normally bone dry this time of year. According to the National Hurricane Center, the storm is expected to continue producing heavy rainfall across the southwestern U.S. this morning that's capable of causing dangerous to potentially catastrophic flooding. We are exclusively reporting that the largest publicly traded hedge fund in the U.S. has attracted a bid from an all-star team of Wall Street investors, setting up a rare, high-profile takeover battle in the industry. Sculptor Capital Management had already agreed to a sale to Rhythm Capital last month, but Journal hedge fund reporter Caitlin McCabe says the new bid by a group led by Boaz Weinstein tops that offer.
So Sculptor, lately it's been known for a series of issues that it's faced. Its assets have stagnated over the past decade. It's gained a lot of attention for its high pay of its chief executive. And then the team that submitted a rival offer for Sculptor is made of a bunch of big names on Wall Street. Bill Ackman, for example, is a well-known activist investor. Boaz Weinstein is known for, among other things, profiting from some significant trades about a decade ago. And Mark Lazary is a debt-focused investor who is a co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team. So Sculptor sent a statement to the Journal that this new proposal only includes committed financing for less than half the amount required to complete the transaction. But according to someone close to the matter, the Weinstein Group is confident that it has sufficient financing for its bid.
Meta is unveiling new features for its microblogging app, Threads. We are exclusively reporting that the Facebook parent plans to launch a web version of Threads early this week in its biggest new feature introduction as it competes with Elon Musk's X, formerly known as Twitter. Threads appeared to be on track to be a smash hit when it launched in early July, but use has plunged in recent weeks, with many citing notable missing features. And Americans are struggling to pay for their cars, with higher interest rates driving severe auto loan delinquencies to their highest seasonally adjusted rate since at least 2006. Today's average new car loan runs a monthly payment of more than $750, with an interest rate north of 9.6%, while rates for used cars are above 13%, according to data from Cox Automotive. And the borrower squeeze could intensify when a student loan payment holiday expires at the end of the month. According to credit reporting agency TransUnion, more than a third of consumers with student loans took on a new auto loan during the pandemic. Coming up, women often pile into the labor force as countries develop, but not in India, where the rate of working women remains stubbornly low, and where even small gains have been hard won. We'll look at why after the break.
Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune in to the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Each week, we bring you stock market outlooks, macroeconomic updates, and investment strategies that can help you succeed. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience about how they navigate uncertain markets. Prepare to be engaged, enlightened, and entertained by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.
There's something conspicuously absent from the Indian workforce: women. India leapfrogged the United Kingdom last year to become the world's fifth largest economy. But as Journal Southeast Asia correspondent Sean Lee reports from New Delhi, India's overall growth hasn't been mirrored in its female labor force participation rate, which peaked in the year 2000. And Sean joins us now with more on this story. Sean, what is the state of women's involvement in the Indian workforce, and how does that just stack up against other countries who've undergone a similar rapid upward economic trajectory as India has?
Right. Well, the state of women in the workforce in India is that they've been retreating from the workforce for the past two decades. As you said, it hit a peak of about 31% in 2000. And since then, it's just been backsliding. It fell to 24% last year. And that makes India a huge outlier because many countries normally see more and more women joining the labor force as its economies develop.
Sean, you spoke to a number of women as well as to employers and economists. What is the cause of these low figures, according to them?
Well, it's two big reasons. One is a lack of jobs, and the second is a deeply conservative culture. So despite India's robust economic growth, it's what economists call a jobless growth. So the country has created zero net new jobs over the past decade. And the second is the conservative culture. In many parts of India, the woman's place is still at home. And it's very hard for women to break out of that. Even the ones who want to work are often prevented from working by their family, by neighbors, just public shaming and censure.
And yet, as you recount, Sean, there's pretty clear information out there about the economic benefits that India could unlock if it can get the number of women in the workforce up.
Right. So McKinsey Global Institute, they have an estimate that India could add $734 billion to its GDP if it boosted the female participation rate by 11 percentage points, which is huge, right? The Indian government, in its latest economic report, made the argument in part that the way labor data is calculated doesn't capture the full extent of women's contribution to the Indian economy, which part of the argument is that unpaid domestic work should be counted as productive work. Now, this is something that major groups tracking labor, feminists over the decades, have made that same argument, but it obscures the fact that it's paid work outside the home that ultimately really makes a difference to a country's economy and also to the lives of women and their families. There's been some efforts by the government to make some headway. They tout the boost in women's education over the years. And that is indeed true. More girls, more women are going to school. Literacy rates are higher. They've opened vocational institutes around the country. They've mandated paid maternity leave. Companies over 50 employees have to have on-site daycare centers. So there have been some efforts by the government to make headway. And despite that, you can see the numbers. It hasn't really been working.
All right, so some government actions there. What are businesses doing about this?
Yeah, so I talked to a couple of businesses. One is a British equipment manufacturer, JCB. They run six factories in India. And they said about a decade ago, they really started making a concerted effort to bring more women into the workplace. But they said it was really, really hard in the beginning, right? They had to go and sit down and talk to these women's families. They had to make special arrangements, like negotiate leases for apartments near factories so women could live together, provide transport to and from factories because women were worried about their personal safety, even hire a psychologist to come visit the factories, partly to counsel female employees on how to withstand family pressure. And I spoke to another company, they're called Blue Smart. They're basically Uber rival, and they really, really wanted to hire hundreds, if not thousands, of female taxi drivers. They launched a program to teach women how to drive and help them obtain driver's licenses. And about 800 women graduated from that program, right? But they only managed to get 80 of those women to join up as taxi drivers. They said even the women who really, really wanted to work, it was very difficult for them to convince their family to allow them to work.
That was Wall Street Journal Southeast Asia correspondent Sean Lee in New Delhi. Sean, thank you so much for bringing us this story.
Thank you.
It's still early days, but artificial intelligence doesn't make much of a portfolio manager. At least 13 exchange-traded funds have put AI in charge of managing portfolios, but almost all have missed out on this year's tech-led market rally and are lagging behind benchmark indices such as the S&P 500, which ironically has been powered by investor enthusiasm regarding AI subjects. Wall Street Journal reporter Bob Henderson explains where AI is falling short and what this means for its future as a portfolio manager.
Several of these ETFs have worked well for a while after they were trained, but then encountered some new paradigm-shifting event, like the regional banking crisis. These are things that hadn't happened for ever, or their particulars were so different that the AI seems to not recognize what to do in those situations. For now, it looks like AI works really well as an assistant with somebody watching over it, but it doesn't seem as though AI is capable of fully taking over the job. That may change, but it will probably require further developments of AI algorithms.
Shares of Chinese property developers fell in morning trading today as the People's Bank of China kept its mortgage rate unchanged. The central bank's decision to hold its five-year reference rate steady disappointed traders who had expected more support to revive the property slump. In a note, economists at UBS described China's property easing efforts as being piecemeal and modest, and the Swiss bank joined JP Morgan and Barclays in downgrading its forecast for China's economic growth. And now to a pair of election results in Latin America, beginning in Ecuador, where former leftist lawmaker Luisa González, who's backed by the powerful ex-president Rafael Correa, topped a first round of presidential voting on Sunday ahead of Daniel Noboa, the son of a wealthy banana magnate. The two candidates will face each other in a runoff vote in October, and Journal reporter Ryan Dubay told us why these elections matter in a country grappling with escalating drug-related violence.
So by far the top issue of the election is violent crime in Ecuador. Homicides have quadrupled from 2019 to 2022, and they're up another 80% so far this year. Fueling that violence is an expansive cocaine trade. That issue became even more apparent when Fernando Villavicencio was assassinated in Quito, the first presidential candidate to be killed in Ecuador's history. So these results matter far beyond Ecuador, not only for whoever will take office will be in charge of trying to control this crime, but also trying to control the amount of cocaine that is leaving Ecuador.
And in Guatemala, Bernardo Arevalo, the son of an acclaimed former leader of the country, won a landslide presidential election victory yesterday, beating out former First Lady and three-time presidential contender Sandra Torres. Arevalo campaigned on an anti-corruption platform, pledging to enhance security and repair Guatemala's ailing public services. And finally, for decades, trains operated by Germany's national rail company Deutsche Bahn were known for their reliability. But last year, one-third of all of its long-distance trains ran late, something that a company spokesperson chalked up to rising traffic, aging infrastructure, and construction projects. But our reporter Hamza Jalani says Germans aren't having it. Venting about transport travails has become Germany's national zeitgeist, and if things don't get back on schedule, the delays could even turn into a cross-border issue.
So the other place that takes punctuality very seriously, if not more seriously, is the home of the Swiss clock, which is Switzerland. And they're pretty fed up with this because the German trains, when they cross the border into Switzerland, are factored into the Swiss timetable. And if the German trains are late, it essentially takes off all of the trains' punctuality within Switzerland itself. And they've really had enough. And now they're having proposals and discussions about saying, you know what? When German trains get to the border with Switzerland, everyone needs to disembark and get on a Swiss train that we trust will show up on time, which will obviously add to the headache for commuters. But Switzerland sees this as the best way to guarantee some level of uniformity in its train system.
And that's What's News for Monday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant and Mohsen Ali. Our supervising producer was Michael Cosmides, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.